This is The Guardian.
Today, officers attempt to turn a Black Lives Matter activist into a mole. What they don't realise? She's recording them. Lowry Davies, a law student at Swansea University in Wales, was in bed, still waking up. It was a Tuesday morning in March this year.
I'm not an early riser, never have been.
Well, not morning, more like afternoon.
Sorry, it was like 1 o'clock, I think, in the afternoon, and I just sort of woke up. There were like 3 missed calls from a mobile number.
The phone rang again, and this time she picked up, and it woke her up pretty fast.
I heard a voice go, "Hello, I'm from South Wales Police." And I, in that moment, went to like Black Lives Matter Swansea mode. So I asked her full name, I asked her badge number and what station she's from. Then she started being like, "Well, I don't really work out of a station." And at that point, I started to open my bedroom door to go into the kitchen to press record on my laptop.
Right.
Yeah. Alarm bells started ringing, to be honest.
The person on the other end wasn't an ordinary cop, and this wasn't an ordinary call. The woman was from police intelligence, a covert officer, and she was asking if Lowry would consider providing her information under the radar. This was something very rarely recorded, and to Guardian investigative journalist Rob Evans, very important.
It's actual proof of the recruitment attempt going on, how they pitch it, what they talk about, how they sort of describe what they want someone to do. 3 times on the tape, the police officer tells Lowry not to tell anyone. And she's right from the beginning trying to impress upon Lowry the secrecy about what they were doing.
"Here we are. Can I just ask, are you done telling? Will you come to meet with us?"
What Lowry had taped and what she experienced in an unmarked police car the next day was the first known attempt by police to infiltrate the UK's Black Lives Matter movement. It's a new chapter in a long, often sordid history of police trying to infiltrate non-violent racial justice groups. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, how the police tried to recruit an informant inside BLM. Lowry, why did you get involved in Black Lives Matter?
Well, I'm from mixed heritage myself. On my father's side, it's mixed black and white. And I engaged in politics at quite a young age, maybe like 13, 14. That was when the Ferguson riots were happening in America and where the Black Lives Matter movement was really happening. So that is how I sort of started engaging in Black Lives Matter.
And a few years later, you went to university. What was your role in BLM Swansea? And was it something that ever brought you into contact with the police?
There was a protest in Cardiff, a Black Lives Matter protest after the murder of George Floyd. And I saw someone post on there, does anyone know if one is happening in Swansea? And I said, "No, there isn't, but I'm thinking of doing one." And this girl replied back with, "Well, let's do it then. We'll organise one." And in 6 days, we pulled off Swansea's biggest protest that we've seen in the recent years. So that was when I first sort of encountered the police, the days before that protest, to ensure safety, because it was growing in numbers and it was important that we had a plan there for the people that were coming.
And how long did it take you to realise that the phone call that afternoon was not like your previous contact with the cops?
It just felt a bit more sinister in the way that she couldn't give me the station that she works out of. I didn't think, "Oh my God, you know, it's covert police." That didn't come to mind.
"Well, I can't clean up at your home address, put it that way, because of the nature of the role that I do."
Sorry, say that last part again.
"Because that wasn't even something on my radar." I don't think that's on anyone's radar, particularly. "Yeah, of course, yeah. We're not all police officers, and we wouldn't just turn up to your your home address and talk to you and call with officers.
And so take me through that call. What did the officer actually have to say to you?
So she explained to me that she was a part of a covert unit who usually works with burglars and drug dealers and organised crime, but that they were interested in the protests in case any violence could potentially erupt.
Because you're obviously organising and organising things, wanting to go as peaceful as possible, and for any sort of potential risk that you could see occurring from...
Not from my side, but from alt-right fascist groups was the sort of reason for contact.
Right. From information you gain from your own Facebook or any sort of social media groups that you're linked to.
And how did you try to verify whether this person was actually a police officer?
Well, at first, you know, I was sort of suspicious that she was a police officer. Because, you know, how do you know without seeing them?
Could I ask, did you get, like, my information then, like, from the police, like my phone number and stuff?
She then accessed my records with the police. She told me when protests have gone ahead, which officers I've spoke to about, you know, the protests going ahead. She read my address out to me. She read my associates out to me. And that is how I knew, yeah.
One of the things that struck me from the call was that she was a bit odd about where exactly you guys would meet.
Yeah. You'd think, you know, if the police want to speak to you, they'd either come to your house, you know, to speak with you, or they'd tell you to go to the police station, you know, and I think that's a normal sort of, you know, reasonable way to meet with the police. And that's why I said, you know, why can't you come to my home? Why can't I come into a station to see you? She said, we're not seen anywhere.
We do meet people at police stations.
Okay.
And we don't meet people at their home addresses because, of the COVID nature of my role, we're not seen anywhere.
I was being asked to effectively get into a car as a single woman in an undisclosed location where I couldn't tell anyone. It doesn't show that the police have a duty of care. The officer reiterated again and again that I could not tell anybody about my whereabouts. I could not tell anybody about the contact.
Fantastic. Just remember not to tell anybody. It's really important not to tell anybody.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Okay, all right. Okay, take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
So that's a pretty striking call to have with a police officer. How did you feel once you'd hung up?
I was absolutely and completely baffled, to be honest. And even in the recording, you know, you can sort of hear me coming in and out. It's because I'm like pacing again, back and forth, pacing around the kitchen because I couldn't get over it. You know, I called my friends and my partner and I just was like, I've been asked to be an informant with the police.
And Larry, you agreed to meet with the officers the next day and you also spoke to them to get some instructions on how you should meet up with them. What did they tell you?
They told me that I have to walk a specific route and then call them when I get to the second location.
Give you further directions from there.
And then they would tell me the third location.
What should I say where I'm going?
Because I asked, you know, what should I say to, you know, to people that asked me where I'm going, because I live, you know, I lived in student accommodation at the time.
I'll just say I'm going to Tesco. It's fine. I always get a meal deal anyway.
And she says, well, no, Tesco's is the other way. You could say that you were going to
B&M.
B&M or...
Yeah, yeah.
I was playing with them a little bit. It was all just to get them to ask me to lie about where I'm going.
I do tell everybody not to bring any sort of recording devices or anything.
They also told me not to bring any recording devices, and that was the instructions.
What are you thinking at this point?
So as I'm sort of leaving to walk down the road, it was really sunny and lots of people were out because, you know, in the UK and especially in Wales, we don't see sun very often. And there I was strutting down the street to meet covert officers. And I was just thinking, as I'm looking around. So I was like, this is the worst spy cop movie I've ever seen. Like, John Wick didn't prepare me for this.
Okay. And so take me through that meeting. You're waiting. And when do you see the car pull up?
The third location, it's at a back of a supermarket. The officer that contacted me reaches when I'm out of the car and shows me her badge. It was so quick, I didn't like take it into my hands and really look at it. Then the second officer gave me his badge when I was sat in the back seat. I was sat in the middle.
And Larry, why did you actually go? I mean, it's, by the sounds of things, you had no intention of actually doing any informing.
No, absolutely not. It was because I couldn't believe that this was real life, and I had to see it to believe it. I had to know that they were officers before I, you know, pursued further action. And I didn't know whether the phone call itself would be enough.
You recorded those initial calls. Did you try to record this meeting?
Yeah. So to be honest, my plan was to use my phone to record rookie mistake, because they did check me when I was in the car. And when my phone came on later in the car, they took the phone and put it in the middle so that they could see it.
Did you try and turn it on when you were in the car?
Yes, I was doing, again, like the worst spy cop movie you've ever seen. I was using like my thighs to try and like turn it on, you know, like sort of like using some pressure to turn it on. So that's why it kept coming on. Also, I wanted to keep putting it on because I had sent my location to my friends. My partner and my friends were actually following the car. Well, attempting to follow the car.
Really? That they were in a car behind you trying to tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did the police have to say to you sitting in that car?
So when I got in the car and the officer that spoke to me was driving, she was in the driving seat, and her superior, the male officer, looked at me and said, you know, I'm a white man. I understand why you do Black Lives Matter.
Great start. Great start to the conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought, wow, this is really something. And it made me freeze up a little bit more, to be honest, because I knew that this was the start of him attempting to persuade me into becoming an informant. So they were asking, you know, they were saying about the alt-right, you know, coming to the protest, because prior to this conversation, the alt-right did turn up to our protest and they were intimidating. But because I felt like they were beating around the bush, I said to them, well, do you want to know who's in BLM Swansea? Because I have tried my best, as well as my other co-founder, to keep the members of Black Lives Matter Swansea secret, except myself and my co-founder. I also asked them if they wanted to know the members of Black Lives Matter, you know, South Wales, to see what they were getting at. Obviously, I would never disclose any or this, at all this information, but it was a test to see what they were actually going for.
What did they say?
They said, well, yeah, you know, they would want to know, and that they would send it to the surrounding areas. They were open to it.
Mm. Were they offering you anything in exchange for this information?
They said that I would be rewarded, but the reward was never defined.
Larry, you went into this having recorded the phone calls, feeling like maybe you had the upper hand here. But then all of a sudden, you're in a car alone with two officers and your friends are struggling to find you. This is all sounding pretty serious all of a sudden. What did it feel like?
How I would explain how I felt and how the situation was, I was so terrified that I became numb. The shock and the upset and the fear had come to a head. I think I was numb because it was really quite traumatizing sitting in the back of an unmarked car, being driven around for an hour and a half while two covert officers are staring at you.
The officers eventually dropped Lowry off, told her she had a week to think about their offer. She, of course, had no intention of taking them up on it. The whole encounter had left her shaken, wondering, how long had the police been watching her BLM group? How long had they been watching her? Rob Evans, you've been investigating police tactics in dealing with activists for years. How likely is it that the police would go to a BLM campaigner for information on the far right?
Oh, there would be no reasonable point for doing that. It doesn't add up. If you wanted information about what the far right were doing, you would recruit informants within the far right. What they're doing there is that they're sort of seeking to hook her in, and then once she's giving them information, then they would turn to what they were really interested in, which is information that she would have, which is about Black Lives Matter movement and other left-wing progressive groups within the area that she lives.
So let's take a step back here. How widespread is this tactic of recruiting informants within activist groups in general?
This is a very opaque and secretive world. And we know that the police have been running a network of informants within political groups. Is something that the police and the state have done for decades. It's just, you know, they have a series of techniques, and this is one of them.
And how do police persuade people to work with them? Like, what is the typical pitch?
Police would sit there for a bit of time before they make a pitch to think out, you know, what will appeal to the person that they're trying to recruit. The first approach would really just be quite, you know, a straightforward offer of money. The second is much darker, and it's a form of coercion. For example, you've been arrested for something, and in the police station they would say, well, we can lower what you could be prosecuted for, or, you know, you wouldn't be prosecuted at all if you come and inform for us. And the third is through some sort of appeal to a higher public duty, or they would play on sort of jealousies or animosity within the group, and to say, you know, the group that you belong to was very moderate and now it's going far more violent. Come and tell us about it and we can help you in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I get why police would seek to get inside groups that are violent or that are extremist in some way, but what are the police seeking to actually achieve by infiltrating groups like Lowry's that are pretty small scale and non-violent?
What the state wants is to know what political groups are up to. They want to find out what political groups are doing in case they become a threat to the status quo. And, you know, the problem for the state is that you've got to start early, I think, in that game, because for them, because they can't just sort of start looking at a group that suddenly begins to cause a lot of disruption in their eyes, you know, at a late stage. They always want to be, you know, monitoring what's going on. They just need to, what the state does is they want to keep an eye on these political groups, and they have quite a, you know, systematic machine which does that year after year.
Yeah, I mean, the other striking thing about this case is that Black Lives Matter actually argue for greater scrutiny of police. And I wonder if the fact that the police are trying to infiltrate that kind of group, if that raises alarm bells for you.
Yes, this is very important, because Black Lives Matter, the group that Lowry was part of, was actually a group that spent quite a bit of time supporting protests about alleged police wrongdoing.
Lowry, why do you think the police were interested in infiltrating Swansea's BLM branch?
Well, as part of Black Lives Matter Swansea, we shed light on the loss of black lives after police custody. Earlier this year, a man named Mohammed Hassan in Cardiff was arrested for breach of peace. He then went into custody, and it's alleged that there was no sort of fight before or anything, that he went into custody without any marks. And he came out of custody and he then later died later that day after being released. There was another case, Mayid Bashir, in Newport, where he was restrained and then died after contact with the police.
And so it's these cases of potential police misconduct that BLM Swansea was protesting about, was trying to raise awareness about. Looking back, what do you make of the way that police tried to persuade you to talk, the kinds of tactics that they used?
I think what they did, what they were trying to do was to recruit me as an informant on Black Lives Matter UK. I think they were specifically Swansea and the surrounding areas as a result of what we were focusing on. And I think this alt-right fascist groups was just a ruse.
Rob, what we've been hearing about here is really just the tip of the iceberg of controversial police tactics, something you've literally written the book about along with Paul Lewis. The things that you and some other journalists have exposed culminated this year in a pretty extraordinary ongoing inquiry. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. I mean, there's a very long-running public inquiry, which is slow-moving, run by a retired judge into the activities of the undercover officers who infiltrated political groups going back right back to 1968. In that time, the undercover officers have spied on more than 1,000 political groups. The inquiry won't publish a full list of those 1,000 political groups, but from public information, you can compile what those groups are. And overwhelmingly, they have been groups that are left-wing, progressive groups. And the inquiry came about because there was a whole slew of allegations and revelations about how those undercover officers had misbehaved, including, for example, deceiving women into long-term relationships, stealing the identities of dead children in order to form their own fake personas. But the thing that pushed the government, and it was Theresa May when she was Home Secretary in 2014, into ordering this public inquiry, which is a big move by a government, was the revelation that the undercover police had been monitoring the campaign of Stephen Lawrence. And Theresa May came to the House of Commons and said this was appalling.
Rob, you mentioned Stephen Lawrence. Stephen, of course, was a young black man who was murdered in a racist attack in 1993, and most of whose killers were never brought to justice, in part because of what a police inquiry determined was an institutionally racist police force.
The Stephen Lawrence family spent years trying to persuade the police to investigate the racist murder of their son properly. And during that time, the police had used 3 undercover officers to gather information about what the family of Stephen Lawrence and the parents, Doreen and Neville, were up to and how they were campaigning. And you can see this happening again and again with at least 17 justice campaigns since the late 1970s. What we've been seeing is how the police undercover officers were used by the police themselves to monitor campaigns by grieving families, normally black families, who were unhappy about the police and were campaigning about the police themselves. And you would see, for example, that you know some of these cases were about families whose relatives had died in police custody.
So in that context, it's quite striking that we still see these tactics used against non-violent groups calling for racial justice.
Yes, and I think this is the question that the police have got to answer in this case.
Coming up, Lowry wonders, is it paranoia if the police really are trying to recruit informers in your group? Larry, you were drawn to this cause by a desire to make some positive change in the world. And instead, you found yourself being asked to form a secret relationship with the police as an informer. What impact did this whole encounter have on you?
Wow, that's a big and important question, I suppose. Whenever I go out now, whenever I leave the house, I'm constantly looking behind me. I'm constantly looking everywhere, you know, to make sure that I'm safe. When new people come into my lives, I don't trust them. I thought as well, maybe there was an informant on me. So I became a little bit withdrawn. My partner and I have been together since February. And I was questioning, is my partner an informant? Are my friends that I've had for 6 years an informant? What about the people that work in my building? Yeah, it absolutely sent me into a spiral. It's really destroyed my trust.
The other thing that jumps out at me here is that most activist groups are based on a sense of solidarity. And now that you know for sure that the police are trying to recruit secret informers from inside your group, has it made you wonder if everyone you're dealing with is, you know, on the level?
Absolutely. And I do sort of, you know, check people now in my head, sort of a test. And it's, yeah, absolutely. I am more suspicious of people and suspicious of people's intentions.
This has clearly been a really tough experience for you, but one of the things you're doing is speaking out about it. And I wonder if that's a way you're trying to turn something really negative into what could potentially be quite a positive thing for you and then for this movement.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason why I came forward about this was because of, you know, if you're 18, you're coming to uni, right? Or you're not coming to uni, you've moved out, you know, you've come to a different town. You want to get involved in activism, right? Great. You want to organise, fantastic. But you need to be aware of the potential fallout, the potential of police, really. It was more of concern for young activists. Because I think if this would have happened to me at 18, it would have shattered me, to be honest.
Do you think you'd like the police involved in this to apologise to you?
I would like an apology, but also, what is an apology if there's nothing behind it? So the answer to that is yes, they can apologise, but what I want to see is them stop infiltrating groups that are non-violent, that are for social justice for no reason.
Larry Davies, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We approached the South Wales Police for comment. They said, quote, South Wales Police will neither confirm nor deny any specific details in relation to this matter. A complaint has been received which refers to contact made by a covert officer. This is currently being considered by the force's professional standards department, and therefore it would be inappropriate to comment further at this time. They also said, the use of informants is a well-established and highly regulated tactic used by police forces across the country to protect the public. Their use is controlled within strict legal parameters by trained, specialised staff, and the accountability and protection of the informant and the public is paramount. They added, protest organisers have an obligation to liaise with police forces, and South Wales Police has a proven track record in working with organisers to facilitate lawful protest while minimising disruption to the wider public. That's it for today. Many thanks to Larry Davies and The Guardian's Rob Evans. You can read the story Rob wrote with another Guardian journalist, Damien Gale, about this attempt to get inside BLM at theguardian.com. And if you're interested in Rob's wider and incredibly influential reporting on police tactics, have a listen to our two-part episode from last December. Just search for Today in Focus, Spy Cops. He did that work with another Guardian journalist, Paul Lewis. And the book they both wrote is called Undercover, The True Story of Britain's Secret Police. Also, I wanted to remind you again that The Guardian's Comfort Eating with Grace Dent is back for a second series, talking to famous guests about their favourite comfort foods. Her conversation with Stephen Fry is out today, and there are new episodes every Tuesday. Listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Casson. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We're back Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.